From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Donald Trump admires leaders who are strong men, authoritarians. He's said so. Now he's in office as President of the United States. In our system, constitutional checks and balances are supposed to constrain the power of every branch of government. Will they constrain Donald Trump? The whole world is watching. Americans, first of all. This hour on Point, our 100-day spotlight continues with a look at democratic oversight in the era of President Trump. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What kind of leadership do you see emerging from the White House of President Trump? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. First, a correction on yesterday's show. In the course of talking yesterday about the new Trump immigration orders, the terrible killing of six at a mosque in Quebec City in Canada came up. Reports of arrests in that case were coming in, and one of my guests, David French, stated that one of the shooters was of Moroccan origin and that the shootings may have been an act of Islamic terror directed at the mosque. We now know that this is not what Canadian police have found. Mohamed Belkadir was arrested but released by police as a witness, not involved in the shooting. The man charged with six counts of murder and five counts of attempted murder is 26-year-old Canadian Alexander Bissonnette, a student whose Facebook page reportedly shows him following right-wing political figures. I am sorry for that mischaracterization as the news was coming in. We want to get the facts right here, always. So let's look at the Trump administration, Trump leadership. We've invited in two guests today with experience and insight on how countries turn to the authoritarian. Joining me now in the studio via Skype from Oberlin, Ohio, is Masha Gessen, journalist and author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. She came to this country on a refugee visa in 1981 as a 14-year-old. Her family was escaping religious persecution in the Soviet Union. She's written about autocracy and Russia for the New York Review of Books. Masha Gessen, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. And joining me in the studio is Doron Acemoglu. He's a Turkish-born professor of economics at MIT, now a U.S. citizen, and the author of the 2012 book, Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty. He's also written a piece recently for Foreign Policy magazine called We Are the Last Defense Against Trump. Doron Acemoglu, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
We've been hearing so much lately. I mean, just today we're hearing David Frum, former speechwriter for President George W. Bush, talking about what he sees as a risk of autocracy in this country. This is a surprising sentence for Americans, a surprising notion given our history in opposition to exactly that. Masha Gessen, when you look out right now, do you see risk factors in the United States of America with our strong constitution and 200 plus years of democratic government with constraints?
I very much do. I mean, first of all, no democracy is secure. And in fact, I would say there's no such thing as a democracy. Democracy is always in the process of building. Democracy is an ideal model that we're not quite sure what it looks like, and we're always trying to achieve it. And I think that the U.S. has not tended to its democracy very well in quite a long time. But specifically, what we have seen over the course of the last 15 years is a concentration of power in the executive branch. First after 9/11, then under President Obama with the gridlock Congress. And I think that we underestimate not just how much this means for the executive branch, but also how much it means for the perception of the presidency among the public. I think that's one of the things that made it possible for Donald Trump to run for autocrat, essentially, and be elected.
Doron, should we have been having this conversation under President Barack Obama? Masha Gessen says the power has been less and less checked in the presidency for 15 years. That takes us back to, 9/11 time? Is this an overdue conversation? Is there something different? Here we are only not even a dozen days into the presidency of Donald Trump.
Well, I think, yes, perhaps we should have had this conversation earlier, and we did. I mean, we've been talking about the concentration of powers in the hand of the federal government because of the war on terror and other issues that have been reflected and arised in the use of executive orders. But I think, by and large, Obama's presidency is how the framers of the Constitution foresaw it. He was highly constrained by Congress, by the judiciary, and he worked largely via the democratic process. Now we are.
He did a lot with executive orders.
He did a lot with executive order, especially because of the gridlock in Congress. But by and large, and that I guess set a very bad precedent. There's no denying that. But by and large, he was not a very powerful president as these things go. I think what we are faced with right now, and that's what I try to argue in the foreign policy article, is that we have a confluence of factors that really puts us in a very dangerous spot, given the historic weaknesses of American institutions.
Weaknesses? We Americans like to think that we have historic strengths in our institutions here.
We do, both weaknesses and strengths. What's very great about American institutions is that they have evolved over time to deal with a range of major problems. But the way that they have done this evolution is, of course, goes back to how they were originally constructed. And the key problem that the framers of the Constitution, people like George Washington and particularly Madison and Hamilton, were trying to solve was that, you know, in the Articles of Confederation, we had a very, very weak presidency. We had a very, very weak system, no federal government essentially to speak of. And the problem was to concentrate powers in the hands of the federal government. And the state system was already a check, and then there were other checks and balances put in there. But the key was you're going to be able to make centralized decision in a very important arena of the world, in economically, politically, in foreign relations. And many of the checks came as afterthoughts, for example, as in the Bill of Rights. Now, we are at a crossroads where many economic and social changes have brought a great dislocation in the lives of the people, and people are looking for new solutions. And we find ourselves at a point where many of the much cherished checks, such as the judiciary, states, Congress, are all weak or have been turned towards weakness because of the special problems that we are facing.
Who says they're weak? They tend to be in one-party hands now. We have a Republican Congress. We have a Republican White House, obviously, though whether Donald Trump follows Republican orthodoxy is another question. And with the nomination of a Supreme Court, new Supreme Court justice, we may have a Republican-nominated, at least, a majority on the court. That doesn't sound weak.
Well, it is weak in the following sense. You know, if you compare the United States to other strong democracies or historically strong democracies, such as the UK, for example, there are many more checks coming from state institutions against a British prime minister to be able to pursue a very rapid agenda of institutional transformation and policy transformation. The civil service is the biggest barrier against such a transformation in the UK context and in other Commonwealth countries. We have the parliament being generally divided and very difficult for parties to organize around a particular point. In the United States, this is the point that I was trying to make with the confluence of factors. You know, these powers have not generally been exploited with a few exceptions, but the U.S. president can actually make a huge number of appointments, as we are witnessing with Donald Trump, many, many U.S. attorneys, federal judges, 4,000 high-level appointments. And these are going to transform the state institutions, and they're going to essentially hierarchically dominate state institutions. So the only check against this is Congress. But Congress today functions very differently than, say, 50 years ago, when it was not a very party-based system. That if you, for example, based on the work that many political scientists have done, if you look at voting patterns 50 years ago, Democrats and Republicans would cross-vote on many, many, many issues. Over the last 25 years, this has declined, and it has come to a certain sort of alarming point at this point where Republicans always vote in bloc, Democrats always vote in bloc. Now, add this to Trump's presidency and willingness to use executive order and appointments to essentially control state institutions, plus a Congress that's dominated by Republicans and both houses, and they're going to vote in bloc. Now, suddenly, most of the checks have disappeared. State-level checks, they're not much in this 21st century. Not much is left.
Marcia Gessen, I mean, everyone, it's still early days, but there's been a lot of action in a hurry. Donald Trump promised that on the campaign trail, and that's what he's doing. So, you know, there are a lot of people saying, well, hang on, give it time. You look at this and say there are risks, and the language may be important. You talk about authoritarianism, but you talk more about autocracy. What do you mean?
Actually, I want to agree with Darren, first of all, that the speed, and you just mentioned this as well, Tom, the speed with which this is unfolding is absolutely extraordinary. And, you know, I've seen this in other countries, but it's usually more of a creep than a race. And this shows just how much power the U.S. president does have, and Donald Trump in particular, with the circumstances under which he came into office, with a fully Republican Congress, a fully Republican Senate, a vacancy of the Supreme Court, many federal-level vacancies. All of that allows him to act extraordinarily fast. The reason I use the word autocracy is just because I think it's more accurate. You know, authoritarianism is a particular kind of regime. Totalitarianism is a particular kind of regime. We don't know what Donald Trump is inventing. I think it may be something different than either of those words, certainly than totalitarianism, but even authoritarianism describes. Autocracy is the rule of one executive. And there's no doubt in my mind that that's the direction in which he's headed.
And the checks of the courts, we've already seen them called on this weekend in the aftermath of the refugee and immigration order. The checks of the Congress, we'll see what happens when he goes there. They don't look significant to you?
They do not look significant to me, the checks of the Congress. The courts, I think, are a different matter. Congress, as Darren said, it votes in a partisan manner, and it's hard for me to see what interest Republicans have in standing up to Trump.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about keeping Democratic oversight constraints on a president who may have a taste for the authoritarian. We're looking at what that takes. We're looking at what's going on. Maybe Donald Trump is simply answering the will of the people who elected him, and maybe he'll respect the constitutional constraints that are right there in the foundation of the United States Constitution. Questions have been raised, even by Republicans, former Republican operatives, already in the early days of this administration. Masha Gessen joins us this hour, journalist, author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Daron Acemoglu is with me. He's got a recent piece in Foreign Policy magazine headlined, "We Are the Last Defense Against Trump." Turkish-born, and we've seen what has happened in Turkey. He's raising alarms here in the United States. You can join us. How do you see the opening moves, opening messages of the Trump administration on this front? Are you gung-ho for the Trump way? Are you concerned the president may overreach? Is he overreaching already? Donald Trump is interesting. He's well known for his expressed admiration for the Russian leader, Vladimir Putin. But not just there. You don't have to go back that far. Last year, early last year in Iowa, then candidate Trump, he called North Korean leader Kim Jong-un a maniac. He called him a maniac. But he expressed admiration for the Korean leader's ability to consolidate power.
You got to give him credit. How many young guys, he was like 26 or 25 when his father died, take over these tough generals, and all of a sudden, you know, it's pretty amazing when you think of it. How does he do that? Even though it is a culture and it's a cultural thing, he goes in, he takes over, and he's the boss. It's incredible.
He's the boss. It's incredible. Called him a maniac, duly noted. But it's interesting there. Saddam Hussein, last summer at a rally in Raleigh, North Carolina, Trump called Iraq Harvard for terrorism. But he had words of grudging admiration for the ruthlessness of its former dictator, Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein was a bad guy, right? He was a bad guy, really bad guy. But you know what he did well? He killed terrorists. He did that so good. They didn't read him the rights. They didn't talk. They were a terrorist. It was over.
And the administration has been tough early on the press where they might read critical messages. Steve Bannon, top strategic advisor there, has said the press should keep its mouth shut for a while here. On Sunday, Fox News, Kellyanne Conway, senior counselor to the president, told host Chris Wallace media outlets should see some heads roll because they missed the meaning of Donald Trump.
We have all the headlines. People should feel embarrassed. Not one network person has been let go. Not one silly political analyst and pundit who talked smack all day long about Donald Trump has been let go. They're on panels every Sunday. They're on cable news every day. Who's the first editorial writer? Where's the first blogger that will be let go that embarrassed his or her outlets? We know all their names.
Heads should roll. People are watching. People are thinking about this. Evan McMullen, of course, he was at the CIA. He was an independent candidate for president. talked to CNN on Thursday, said Trump's attacks on the media, he said, represent authoritarian tendencies.
Donald Trump, through the past year, has said that he admires dictators and authoritarians from around the world. They attack the press because they want to undermine any other sources of information so that people start to believe that only the authoritarian can be the source of information. Because if authoritarians are able to do that, if leaders are able to undermine every other source of information, source of facts and truth, no one can hold them accountable.
Masha Daron, we want to get to you and learn from your experience, your insights, but we want to hear directly from our listeners as well. Jason in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Jason, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, what do you think?
Well, I want to start. I'm not a Trump supporter. I did not vote for Trump. I decided to give the guy the benefit of the doubt when he was elected.
Yep.
What's happening is he's leading us down a road that is just further polarizing this nation, whether you want to call it authoritarianism or not. He's pushing the left and the right further apart. What's going to happen is this is going to get to a point where the left is going to do everything that they can do to stop anything that the right wants to do. The right's going to do anything that they can do to stop what's going to happen on the left. This is going to start almost a war between these parties and the American people, because everyone's going to these extremes, it seems, anymore. I don't understand how we go from, you know, we have different parties who vary very little in what they want to do with the country. So now all of a sudden we're going from almost, an authoritarian government to the left. You know, they're the ones that are free, you know, all about freedom and everything else. Trump's not doing anything that he didn't say he was going to do when he was running for office. I'm not surprised by anything he's done. What I'm surprised by is the reaction from people who should have seen this coming.
Jason, do you think it's right for us to have our antenna up right now to be having this kind of conversation or not?
Well, I think that we need to be watching. Yes, we do. Our antenna definitely needs to be up, because this is our country, and I'm a young guy. I'm seeing the way things are going, and they're going the wrong way very quickly.
Jason, I appreciate your call a lot, and I thank you for it. Let me get one more right here. Watoma, Wisconsin. Elaine, you're on the air. Thank you for calling, Elaine.
Oh, hi, Tom, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
President Trump, to me, he's already trying to carry out the promises he made on the campaign trail. And I can't remember the last president who tried starting to do that before he was elected. I trust Donald Trump. I haven't trusted a president in years. I don't trust the Bushes. I don't trust the Clintons. This is someone that America needs, and we need fresh ideas. We need jobs. We need to change the world a little bit here.
Elaine, I hear you. I hear you. You trust him. I hear it. Do you trust that he will, Elaine? Do you trust that he will act within the constitutional constraints that are there on the presidency as he pursues those goals? Elaine?
Well, I think that for once, I think he'll do all right. This is.
I take that as a maybe. That sounds like a maybe. I mean, with respect.
Give him some time. I think he'll do great. I really do. But I think you guys are all the maybes, not me. Okay, I trust him.
Elaine, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Marsha Gessen, let me come first to you. You know, first caller says, well, he's really unsettled by how things are going, but this is what Donald Trump said he would do, and now he's doing it. Second caller, straight up, she trusts him, and these are promises, and these are delivering on promises.
Oh, he's certainly delivering on his promises, and I think that there were a lot of people who were worried about what he was saying on the campaign trail, who somehow hoped against hope that he wouldn't. He's doing exactly what he said he was going to do, which is, generally speaking, what people do in the public eye. He's not unusual that way. I think it's not surprising. It is shocking, but it's not surprising. But one thing that I want to focus on that he is doing that he said he was going to do is when he said drain the swamp, I'm sure that he meant that he is fundamentally opposed to American institutions as they're currently constituted. You know, he doesn't just mean clean them out so that they will work better. He means destroy the institutions. And I think that's very much what he has set out to do. We see that in, you know, his reality show style firings. We see that in the way he talks about institutions. We see that in the way that he has chosen a person to lead every agency who is actually opposed to the mission of that agency. You know, this is a whole different kind of animal than we've seen. And his expression of admiration for Putin and Kim Jong-un are, you know, they're not accidental. He has a very primitive understanding of what it means to be in power in a state. He thinks that concentration of power and full control is actually the goal of the chief executive. And that's what he's reaching for.
Daron, you know, the Constitution stands there.
It does.
How do these things get, if they're undermined, how do they get undermined? How does the citizenry accept that? Or when it happens? I mean, it seems to have happened in Turkey.
It happens so many times. It has happened in so many countries. I mean, the point of the book, Why Nations Fail, that James Robinson and I co-wrote, is to not just to emphasize that institutions mattered for a nation's prosperity, but to also illustrate that those institutions change all the time. They go from bad to better, and they go from better to worse. And we have countless examples in history of countries having better institutions, institutions that protect citizens, protect the economy, and suddenly collapsing. And in the recent past, we've seen this in Argentina with Perón. We've seen it more recently with Chavez in Venezuela, with Putin in Russia, with Erdogan. And in all of these cases, you know, authoritarianism doesn't exist in a vacuum. It starts with real grievances, social and economic, mm-hmm. that have really been important.
And we want to respect
States.
That because there's exactly. so much, that is embedded in this last election.
It is. And in some sense, we are guilty because we've been asleep at the wheel and we did not pay attention to those grievances. And that opened the door for Trump. But many of these would-be autocrats exploit these grievances, exploit polarization. And out of this, they build what I characterize sometimes as a personal rule, a system in which all authority is vested in them. And I think it's best characterized by a scholar of Venezuelan politics who wrote, by the name of Krauss, said, Chavez doesn't act like you're the president of Venezuela. He acts like its owner. And if you look at Erdogan, if you look at Putin, if you look at Trump, it's exactly the same tendency. It's this wish to centralize power in their hands. And people will say U.S. Constitution, but a lot of this is de facto. You know, Erdogan did not change the Turkish constitution. He's become a veritable autocrat, but he's still trying to change the U.S. Turkish constitution. But, you know, the deed is done. De facto, he has concentrated all the powers in his hands. Much of what Putin did in Russia, Masha would know this much better, but it's really is not by changing constitutions, but it's actually changing how institutions work on the ground, changing the norms, changing the practices, and capturing the civil servants, the bureaucrats, the security apparatus.
We've got David Frum this morning talking about this. Of course, he was right there in the heart of the George W. Bush administration, now a senior editor of The Atlantic. Got a cover story there. You can link to it at our website. He told NPR's Steve Inskeep on Morning Edition that the U.S. is not immune to the rise of an authoritarian leader, an autocrat.
What I describe here is a process of corruption that needs to change the rules for its own self-protection, and that gradually, one by one, working with a Congress that is held hostage by the agenda it wants to pass, gradually undercuts American legal norms.
Gradually undercutting American legal norms. We don't want to see that happen. We do not want to see that happen. There's no guarantee that's going to happen, but it's interesting where the questions are coming from here, including some quite conservative commentators. Cheryl in New Orleans. Cheryl, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. What I see is, first of all, I want to say that Trump is a fascist. And I see parallels between what Trump is doing with the Muslim ban and, the start of what Hitler did with the Jews. And, I take this very personally. My mother's family fled Nazi Germany. They were German Jews. And thank God they were able to come to this country flee that horror.
Cheryl, fascist is a very strong word. Comparing to Hitler is a very strong comparison.
Yeah, I see parallels because, you know, what you do is you take a certain group of people and you make them the scapegoat. And that is what I see Trump starting to do right now. You know, he's using the Muslim community as a scapegoat, sort of as a smokescreen for some of the other stuff that he wants to do. I find this terrifying. And if we as a, you know, a people in the U.S. Don't see the warning signs before we know it, you know, we can end up an authoritarian nation with, a constitution which has no meaning.
I mean, we're told from early on that eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. So the vigilance, I completely agree. Americans always have to have it, always have to have it. These are dire comparisons, Daron. I mean, to your eye, you've looked across countries around the world. Is that anywhere in the realm of what we're talking about here?
Well, fascism is a very, very big umbrella, and I think it's used and misused in many different ways. But what I would characterize as the ideological core of many of these regimes, Peron, Chavez, Putin, Erdogan, is aggressive populism centered around a nation or a tribal conception. Aggressive populism because it defines some group of people pitted in a war against others, against more powerful group, and many of these lines are drawn with national or religious-based rhetoric. Mm-hmm. So in Erdogan's case, early on, this was the more pious, Muslim, poorer parts of the Turkish population against the well-educated, mm-hmm. secular Turkish elite. Mm-hmm. Later, once that coalition shifted, he immediately shifted the rhetoric to be Turks against Americans and Europeans. Mm-hmm. So the boundaries shift, but what's so constant is that this aggressive definition of the economy, social policy, foreign policy on an axis of us against them. And that's very dangerous, and it really creates the environment for this institutional slide that we were just mentioning.
I mean, it sounds like it should be way outside the American conversation, and yet we have familiar voices raising this kind of thing now. We had Carl Bernstein covered Watergate, the last days of the President Nixon for the Washington Post, and here he was talking last year with CNN's Brian Stelter about Donald Trump.
I'm not talking about Hitlerism and genocide, and I'm not making a direct parallel to Mussolini, but a kind of American fascism that we haven't seen before, different than George Wallace, who was merely a racist. This goes to authoritarianism. It goes to despotism, the desire for a strong man who doesn't trust the institutions of democracy and government.
Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame. Masha Gessen, does that language seem appropriate to you, or is that way out? Is he out over his too far over his skis there?
I think his language is perfectly appropriate. I don't know how useful Hitler comparisons are because they get us into a trap where people say, well, you know, he's not headed for mass extermination. We have no evidence, no reason to talk about mass exterminations. So perhaps setting the Hitler comparison aside, let's talk about what he's doing to actually damage the culture and the institutions of this country. He is employing rhetoric that we haven't really seen before, certainly not in living memory of us against them. He's employing rhetoric that's characteristic of nation states, that this country, being multi-ethnic and multi-religious, has generally avoided. He is taking us down a path that we haven't been before. This is uncharted territory.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about keeping democratic oversight constraints on a president with an apparent taste for strongman rulers, what that takes and what's going on right now. Masha Gessen is with us via Skype from Oberlin, Ohio, author of The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Daron Acemoglu is with us. He's out of MIT, a co-author of Why Nations Fail, and We Are the Last Defense Against Donald Trump in the most recent issue of Foreign Policy magazine. You can join us in this hour. What do you see going on here? With one party now dominating the executive, the legislative, and soon perhaps the high court, with Donald Trump at the head, will our checks and balances work? Where are we headed here? Donald Trump has been very clear about how he sees himself in within this Democratic array, a kind of unique way of expressing his capacity to address the country's problems. Here he was at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio.
Nobody knows the system better than me. Which is why I alone can fix it.
I alone can fix it. Now, a lot of voters came to Mr. Trump. Not the absolute majority, but enough to make him president of the United States under our system. That's got some people really with the heebie-jeebies right now, with just feeling like, what's going on? You can take it any way you want. Bill Maher, with HBO's Real Time, comedian, political commentator, described Trump as a fascist in the context of prohibiting EPA employees from posting to social media.
He muzzled agencies. EPA can't tweet or talk anymore. In combination with this concept of alternative facts. So you can't get out the real facts, EPA. So the only facts we hear are the alternative facts. I'm just saying it's easy to get distracted. I'd like to keep their eye on the big picture of all these things, which to me look like a strongman fascist country.
Maybe you think that's way, way too far. But can we talk about it? We'll see. Last year, Donald Trump said he wanted to bring out libel laws, stronger libel laws to deal with a press when he said they had negative or horrible false articles.
I'm going to open up our libel laws so when they write purposely negative and horrible and false articles, we can sue them and win lots of money. We're going to open up those libel laws.
Okay, but this is the USA. We have the freedom to talk about it. We're going to do that. Ian, in Asheville, North Carolina. Ian, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Love listening to the show, going to work.
Thank you. What do you think, Ian?
Hey, I just want to say that I voted for Trump. 4 years ago, I voted for Obama. But nothing that he's done is really harmful right now to this country. Yeah, he says things and he shoots off his mouth sometimes without thinking, but we all do that. And when it comes to the executive orders that he's putting in place, I really feel like he's putting this country first, and that's what it should be. It should be this country and us first. And I know that sounds bad, but that's what the president's job is. We look too much. It seems like we look too much at the headlines of the stories about what Trump's doing with the executive orders and not really reading about the executive orders and what's inside of them.
Ian, I respect your interpretation of what's going on, but you do well know, and of course many others share your view, Ian. I get that, but you know that there's also alternative views here. That you know what's going on. Let's say with the refugee policy and immigration is, you've got voices saying this is hurting us, our reputation around the world. We heard on NPR this morning a report saying that top national security officials from who are now out of power, but are saying this puts us in a worse situation. I guess my question is, do you think Donald Trump will listen to alternative views?
I think he will. And we got to keep in mind, he's only been in office, you know, not even a month yet. And the refugee crisis, I get that. That's horrible. I have two kids. And when I see the picture of the children in Syria, I mean, it breaks my heart. But we got to keep in mind that everybody's jumping saying that it's a Muslim ban. It's a Muslim ban. It's seven countries from where they are known terrorist ties, whether it's Hamas, ISIS. We're not even looking at the other countries where there's a Muslim majority population where there's no ban on them countries. It's just the seven countries where they are known terrorist organizations breeding from right now.
Ian, we've got it, and we hear it, and I've just got more to get to, but I really appreciate your call, and we can see you're paying close attention, and we hear how you see it. Daron, Ian says, look, Donald Trump said he wanted to put America first. That's what he's doing. Nothing wrong here, and let's settle down.
I don't think it's putting America first to create an environment which is not consistent with our values and furthers this polarization in society. You know, U.S. institutions have evolved strongly over the years, not perfectly, but strongly, partly because we are an open society. You know, it has happened before. Today, we are a much richer, much more cultured society in some sense because we have so many different people who have come into this melting pot. But at the beginning of the 20th century, people tried to expel Italian immigrants because they could have been anarchists, and there were some anarchists carrying out terrorist plots within the United States. But we didn't do that. We didn't do that because this was not viewed to be consistent with the American constitutions and the American values. And I think that's the way to strengthen this country's overall potential for the future. And the real danger here is, even if it were the case that an executive order of this sort might temporarily be good for American security, I think the long-run institutional implications of it are so dire that we really have to thread extremely carefully.
Matthew in Detroit. Matthew, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi. I lived in Turkey for 9.5 years. So when he says Erdogan, that's the leader of Turkey, for those that don't know. And although I'm a huge Trump supporter, I think he's doing I don't apologize. I'm glad it's America First. But he'll tell you how many times Erdogan keep, and it starts with controlling the press, how many journalists have been thrown in jail. Now, it hasn't gotten that with Trump. And I'm so fired up because there's so much misleading information in the press. But it is a concern, even though I like what Trump's doing. He's doing exactly what he said. The Constitution rocks because we're seeing the Electoral College come through. The Democrats can make their case and get elected. But in my thing, there is some concern. I mean, he can talk about one of the first things. We lived there when Tayyip Erdogan came into power. He got the economy kind of propped up. But then talk about how many journalists have been thrown in jail in Turkey. And that's one of the first things you see. You could go to Russia, and the state ends up controlling the media. So I see a little bit of that. But at the same time, and again, it is a refugee ban, not a Muslim ban, because a lot of Muslim countries can still come to America.
I hear Matthew. I appreciate your call. I mean, this concern about the press is out there as well, and Donald Trump's attitude there. Steve Bannon says, shut their mouths for a while. We heard Kellyanne Conway. I mean, it's interesting, Masha Daron. You've got Jennifer Rubin writing in the Washington Post. She's a conservative writer there, right? It's the Right Turn blog for them. But she's up in arms lately. She says Trump's anti-democratic tendencies, his insistence on his delusional version of events being the sole source of information she's worried about. She says his obsession with adulation and his team's determination to obliterate any bearers of objective truth she's worried about. It's interesting. She says Republicans have a special obligation. She says they cannot be handmaidens to Trump's assault on the truth, and if they think that staying mute when Trump tramples over democratic norms will buy them breathing space, they should think again. Relative silence betrays a fundamental lack of courage, disregard for core democratic principles. Jennifer Rubin, conservative blogger, writer there for the Washington Post, but people want to give, the voters who voted for him want to give him a chance to deliver. And there's the tension. Hamid in Boston. Hamid, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm an immigrant. I'm an Iranian-American. I came to the U.S. when I was 13. And I have lived under an authoritarian regime. And this smells a lot like it. It feels like...
You mean in Iran, Hamid?
Yes. And so when I see Trump, when I hear Trump, when I see what, and it's only been a week, when I see what they're doing, it is very eerily similar and very frightening.
For example, like what, Hamid? You've got the experience of living through this in Iran. What makes you feel deja vu?
I'm right, everyone else is wrong. Denying facts that are in their face. Just from every level of it, looking at how they portray themselves as the only people who can solve problems, the misconception, for example, with this recent ban, which has completely negatively affected my community of all religions. There are Iranian Americans here of all faiths,
yeah.
And we came here to build a new life for ourselves. The fact that countries who have citizens and countries who have participated in 9/11, and they are not banned from coming here. Not a single Iranian American that's been here has been involved in any terrorist activity in the United States of America. It is frightening to me to watch him belittle. And the frightening part is this is just the start. And I fear a lot worse if there is, God forbid, a terrorist attack on this soil. My community, my people. All immigrants are in danger of being ostracized and separated from society.
Hamid, we I really appreciate your call, and hang in there. We're listening. We're listening closely, and we appreciate your sharing your experience. Masha Gessen, the country is listening right now and watching what's happening. You know, some are doing much more than that. We saw huge crowds out right away after the inauguration. We saw them out right away again after the refugee executive order and immigration last week. But what do you think, with your experience watching, being in the Soviet Union, watching Russia, Vladimir Putin, what should Americans watch out for now? What should they be alert to?
Well, I think that first of all, and this has come up several times during this conversation, we have to stop confusing popular support with democracy, right? Democracy is not the tyranny of the majority. The fact that a lot of people support Vladimir Putin, a lot of people have supported Erdogan, and a lot of people are now supporting what Donald Trump is doing, doesn't make what he's doing more legitimate. The destruction of American institutions, the his actions against American values, you know, that can't be underestimated. Democracy is a model of representation. Democracy is also a model of checks and balances. Those are the things that he is destroying, and the tyranny of the majority will not sort of make them more legitimate. But I'm heartened by the protests. I think that the one thing that really sets the United States apart from other countries that have phased down aspiring, that haven't been able to phase down aspiring autocrats, that have faced the rise of autocrats, is the strength of its civil society. It has an extraordinarily strong civil society that has, for peculiarly American reasons, not been in any way tied to state support. And I think we're seeing that coming out, sort of the entire spectrum, beginning with protesters on the ground and ending with the professional civil society, such as the ACLU, successfully challenging parts of the Muslim ban. And of course, it is the Muslim ban. It is not a ban on refugees, although a ban on refugees is bad enough.
Well, but I mean, it is seven countries. They are majority Muslim. I take your point, but okay.
But it also applies to immigrants, and yep. For over the weekend, it also applied to people who have who are legal residents of this country.
Yeah, it's amazing. Daron, your advice on what to watch out for, what Americans should be paying closest attention to now. They voted for change. They want change, many Americans. On the other hand, we value deeply the political tradition of this country. It is our bedrock. It's why we're here.
Yeah. I mean, change is good from time to time. But I think we are going through unusual times, and we have to be vigilant. We have to be aware. That's what I was trying to say.
Watch out for what?
Watch out for what's going on to our institutions. And protest. I think that's very important. Vote. You know, there are elections coming in 2 years' time. I think the reason why Erdogan and Putin and Chavez's rise was so swift is because their civil societies were weak. Their media was not sufficiently independent. It became easily captured. Mm-hmm. By the way, all three of these autocrats were extremely clever and extremely successful in demonizing the parts of the media that they couldn't control. And I'm afraid the same might be going on here already. And the thing
we've certainly seen the president himself call out the media.
This is the main opposition party, right?
And Bannon, the opposition party.
That's so common in Turkey when Erdogan could not control it. And the thing that's why we have to be vigilant is because, you know, I think these parallels, of course, all these parallels are imperfect. But when you look at Putin, when you look at Erdogan, it took them several years to get to the point where Trump has gotten in 10 days. You know, Erdogan was much more respectful of the media, of the opposition, of some of the institutions in his first 3 or 4 years. Now we are seeing this really breakneck pace of how things are changing, and we really have to be totally vigilant. If, of course, U.S. society is as aware of what's going on and is willing to protest and go and put pressure on its congressmen and congresswomen, on its judges, so that the judges actually act in the way that they do rather than be afraid of being fired, like people have already gotten fired. And
the acting attorney general.
Acting attorney general. Or the State, Trump, yep. State Department employees who are being threatened by the press secretary.
If you don't like it, go away.
So I think those are, you know, how do you decide when you're a career bureaucrat? Well, a crucial factor is how much pressure you are feeling from civil society. That was absent in Russia. That was entirely absent in Turkey, and we saw where that took us. It set institutions, democracy, back by at least one, probably two or three generations in these countries.
Do you share Masha Gessen's confidence in the strength of American civil society?
No, not entirely.
I wouldn't call it confidence. I'd call it hope.
Okay. I have exactly the same hope, but I'm afraid that we are normalizing – well, we were normalizing Trump before the inauguration. I think the last 10 days are more encouraging because as he has started his campaign of flurry of executive orders and policies, I think there is a waking up. If this waking up can continue – I think we are safe. But I think there is always a tendency for normalization. There is a tendency within the Republican Party, which we have already seen, that has totally regrouped around him.
Eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. We are seeking to be vigilant right here, wide awake, woke, and we're very grateful for the two of you for helping us with that. Daron Acemoglu, thank you very much for being with us today. Masha Gessen in Oberlin, Ohio. Masha, thank you for joining us. It's always great to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Listeners, a quick special call out to you today. We want your ideas about stories and trends that might deserve a closer on-point look into your world, your community, your workplace, your region, something you think ought to be talked about right here. Go to On-Point Listens, hashtag On-Point Listens, that page at onpointradio.org, and give us your idea for an On-Point Hour. We may be in touch to learn more. Thank you for your calls, for all of your attention online. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.